This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Welcome to Health and Living with me, Ti Xiao Yik. For too long, lung cancer has been burdened by its reputation of being a condition that has poor survival and outcomes for patients. But treatment of lung cancer has come a long way since the days when only surgery, radiotherapy or chemotherapy was available. There are now advancements in diagnostic and treatment methods which can save more lives than ever, which is, of course, a good news for all of us. So today, I'm going to be speaking to Prof. Dr. Padmanadhan Rajadure, consultant pathologist, and Dr. Martin Melo Abdullah, consultant clinical oncologist, about what some of these game changers are when it comes to lung cancer diagnosis and treatment, and how, importantly, to ensure that patients are able to access them. Thank you so much, Dr. Martin and Prof. Padma, for joining me today. I think I want to start with a broader look first, Dr. Martin. We know that smoking has long been linked with being the main cause of lung cancer. And this is, of course, still true. But has the picture changed a little bit today? Who else is at risk of lung cancer that we should not overlook?
Well, it hasn't really changed very much. Smoking still remains by far the most common cause of lung cancer. But there are other causes, like secondhand smoking, for example, is becoming more prevalent as well. Radon gas exposure in certain mining activities, industries, causes more lung cancer in those who are exposed to those. There's also genetic susceptibility and also those patients who have scars in their lung owing to previous infections like tuberculosis are at slightly increased risk of developing lung cancer. But I stress again, smoking is by far the most common cause of lung cancer.
And what are some early and late signs of lung cancer? I mean, from an individual's perspective, what might they experience?
I think the signs and symptoms of lung cancer, unfortunately, do not differentiate between early and late stage. By the time they are symptomatic, a lot of the symptoms may in fact indicate advanced lung cancer. There are some of the symptoms that may indicate lung cancer includes cough, that doesn't go away or gets worse over time. This thing called hemoptysis, where one coughs up blood in their phlegm. Presence of chest pain, discomfort, difficulty in breathing, wheezing, hoarseness of voice, loss of appetite, weight loss. Those are some of the signs and symptoms of lung cancer. But these are by no means specific to lung cancer, though. And they're certainly not, usually not the early signs.
And Prof, I'd like to turn to you now. You know, for us lay people, when we are told about the dangers of lung cancer, we are shown pictures of blackened lungs. But really, I think in order to really get an understanding of how bad lung cancer can be, maybe you could describe to us what's actually happening in the lung cells of someone who has cancer. How are the cancer cells taking over our lungs?
So I think it is becoming very clear to us that most lung cancers occur because of what we term driver mutations. These are genetic events that occur very early on. And these mutations are what propels the cancer cells to grow, to become much more aggressive, to invade the tissue around the neighboring normal lung, if it starts in the lung, as it's usually the case and what we're discussing here. They acquire, as they grow, additional mutations, which gives them a survival advantage, the ability to get it to the bloodstream and go to other parts of the body. So basically, what I'm trying to say is that we are now at that point when we understand that although we talk about lung cancer as a general disease, everybody's lung cancer is different. So lung cancers at the molecular level are different, and they're distinguished by unique genetic mutations that propel that cancer to grow, to proliferate, to invade, and to metastasize. Metastasize means to spread to other parts of the body. And as Martin has mentioned, some of these agents that cause these mutations would be things like smoking, radiation, even environmental pollutants, asbestos, and so on. There is probably also a very small subset of patients who are at genetic risk for lung cancer, but these are not really been worked out very well, although we do know that there is that genetic susceptibility, but it's a very small percentage of patients.
What does it tell us if we know that every person's lung cancer is different? Genetically, the mutations are different in every individual. How does that help somebody like you, somebody like Dr. Martin, treating the patient?
Well, the typical process is that a person who is symptomatic, which means having the symptoms that Dr. Martin mentioned, you know, having hemoptysis or whatever in when they cough, they would go and get an examination. And if lung cancer is suspected, they'd have a biopsy and a bit of tissue is removed from the tumor. And that's analyzed by a pathologist such as myself. We would first of all confirm that it's cancer. We would then confirm that it's actually a cancer that's originating in the lung. And we would want to be sure that it's a particular type of tumor called a non-small cell lung cancer. Because these two large groups, the small cells and the non-small cells, are different. And it's critical that we make that distinction, because non-small cell lung cancers are the ones that we now believe are driven by the mutations where we have drugs readily available. The story is unfolding for small cell carcinomas or small cell lung cancers as well, but it's not as far advanced, and there are still clinical trials that are ongoing. So once we have made the diagnosis that this is a non-small cell lung cancer, the next step would be to identify which are the specific mutations that are responsible for propelling the cancer, helping it grow, metastasize, and so on. Because if we can identify that mutation, then if there is a drug that is readily available that exquisitely targets that mutation, then that is the realization of precision medicine or targeted therapy.
All right. You know, let's get into that a little bit later. But, you know, before we get to that point, I just want to take a few steps back first. Dr. Martin, earlier when you talked about some signs that might indicate, and you did say they're not necessarily specific to lung cancer. So there is still a long way to go from a patient potentially having early stage lung cancer to finally being able to get that diagnosis down pat, right? What's that story like in between? What are the challenges you are facing?
Well, I think Dr. Palmer has alluded to the steps involved. When somebody comes with the symptoms and one is suspecting lung cancer, the steps involved would be, of course, to work them up by doing screen scans, identify the presence of the abnormality, and biopsy of that abnormality to confirm the diagnosis of lung cancer. Now, part of the workup, the clinical workup, when we ascertain the diagnosis, also involved staging the disease, meaning the scans would scan basically the whole body to see where it may have spread, whether it spread to the within the lung or to the other lung or to other parts of the body. And the stage at which that is thus established with the presence of the scan basically determines what stage we are at and whether we are able to offer treatment that's going to be curative. The biopsy, of course, is very important. It's vital, in fact, to make a diagnosis of lung cancer. And as alluded to earlier on, there are, I suppose, three levels of identification. The first one is to identify the presence of lung cancer. The second is to make sure that the disease that you get in the lung is indeed arising from the lung cells. And the third aspect of it is, with the molecular profiling, identify what is driving that cancer to decide then on what is the appropriate treatment for that individual.
What if patients haven't even come to you at the point where you suspect lung cancer, though? How many people are walking around with some form of perhaps early lung cancer that, you know, is potentially spreading, becoming more advanced, but it's just not being picked up?
Well, that's a difficult question to answer, really. With lung cancer, we know, I think there are a lot of data that suggests that by the time they present to you in the at the clinical level, majority of them are already at an advanced stage, at least stage 3A, B, stage 4, even for that matter. And unfortunately for lung cancer, there aren't any screening programs that are available or widely available, not without attempts by the clinical fraternity and medical fraternity to attempt that. There have been many clinical trials that look at different forms of screening tests to see whether that would impact the diagnosis, impact the staging of the disease, and impact the outcome when they get treated. It has been shown more recently with more targeted screening where you CT scan screen individuals who are at high risk of developing lung cancer, i.e. the smokers, that you may be able to pick up the disease early enough in whom when you treat them, you can achieve a chance of cure. In the absence of the screening program, by and large, the so-called early lung cancer that are being picked up are usually being picked up incidentally when the patients are being investigated for something else or when they present themselves for medical checkups. And in that situation, you may, you know, incidentally find something in the lung that potentially may be curative, because they're presented at an earlier stage without symptoms.
So there's really nothing that can give us the kind of screening the way that we could talk about mammograms for breast cancer, perhaps, yes. You know, or pap smears for cervical. There's nothing like that for lung cancer.
Unfortunately, there aren't any like that. Yeah. Mm.
So how do we change the trend of so many people coming in at the late stages?
That's going to be very difficult as well. I think, obviously, in the group that are working in high-risk environment, the awareness should be high. And those who are smoking, for example, should be well aware that they are at higher risk of developing cancer. And those are the groups that probably potentially should go for screening as required, as indicated. For the rest of us who don't smoke, then going for screening for lung cancer really doesn't make any sense at all to pick the lung cancer early, unfortunately.
All right. You know, we'll go for a quick break now. And when we come back, we'll explore more about how if, you know, we still are at a point where we are really able to target at least the high-risk smokers to come in for screening. And if we can put in the proper steps, as both Dr. Martin and Prof. Padma have described, from biopsy to the kind of granular, you know, the molecular profiling that can be done to stage and to enable precision medicine to take place, how that's going to change the picture, at least for patients that we can diagnose and identify. So we'll come back and explore more of, you know, how that looks like and what exactly is precision medicine when it comes to lung cancer. And speaking to Prof. Dr. Padmanabhan Rajadure, consultant pathologist, and Dr. Martin Melo Abdullah, consultant clinical oncologist. We're discussing how lung cancer treatment has evolved. You are listening to Health and Living, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, T. Xiao Yi. Joining me on Zoom today, Dr. Martin Melo Abdullah, consultant clinical oncologist, and Prof. Dr. Padmanabhan Rajadure, consultant pathologist. Two different perspectives sharing on lung cancer today, how the diagnosis and treatment of lung cancer has advanced today to enable precision medicine, targeted, tailored treatment to suit each individual's specific kind of lung cancer. And I like what Prof. Padma has mentioned about how lung cancer is different from one person to another. And that those differences, those genetic differences really are what can change the picture of a treatment for lung cancer. Prof., what you talked about earlier in terms of being able to identify specific mutations in each individual, is that what the technology of next generation sequencing does?
Yes. Next generation sequencing basically is a technology that looks at genetic mutations, theoretically hundreds, maybe even thousands of different molecular aberrations in a cell, and typically in a cancer cell. And it is sophisticated technology, and there are many different platforms out there. And depending on the platform you use, what we are trying to do is to determine the presence of driver mutations. Since we're talking about lung cancer, we're trying to detect unique driver mutations which are targetable, which means that there are drugs available that can specifically target cancer cells that derive or that carry that mutation. And again, depending on the size of the panel, you can cast a very wide net to pick up all the important molecular mutations that have been described thus far for lung cancer.
Do we know or have we identified all possible driver? I guess this is where genetics is so vast. Can we possibly say we know all the mutations that are out there linked to lung cancer?
Not by the most elastic stretch of imagination. I don't think so. I think more and more are being discovered every day. And I would think that there's probably about 35% of lung cancers where we still do not know what the driver mutations are. Certainly for squamous cell carcinomas, the presence of driver mutations is even less than for adenocarcinomas. So within the non-small cell group, there are these two different subgroups, the squamous and the adeno, squamous being more common smokers, adeno, less often associated with smoking. So adenocarcinomas tend to be biomarker rich. And therefore, the focus has been actually to try as far as possible to pick up the driver mutations that are present in non-small cell lung cancer of the adenotype. Even there, half or a bit more than half of the driver mutations are detected. Again, the caveat is that you must use a technology that is capable of picking up all the important driver mutations. And there are panels out there that look at maybe 20 gene mutations. There are others that look at 50. There are others that look at far more. So how wide a net you cast is going to have some kind of implication on what your success rate of picking up these genetic mutations are.
Why wouldn't it be standard that you just cast as wide a net as possible?
Okay, because as I said, there are different technologies out there marketed by different vendors, and not all vendors' systems are equal. Some of them have systems that are capable of picking up more mutations than others. Some have technologies that are more sensitive than others, and especially for lung cancer, because the disease progresses so quickly, it is important that we have a platform that detects these driver mutations in the shortest possible time so that we can start targeted therapy as soon as possible. And sometimes large panels take a longer time to complete as opposed to smaller panels.
And Dr. Martin, we know when it comes to your side of the story, so how does this information lead to precision treatment for a patient?
Well, as far as treatment is concerned, at this day and age, they are molecular driven. Now, with somebody who was recently diagnosed with lung cancer, as I mentioned, the typical steps would be diagnose lung cancer, confirm it from the lung, and with the NGS, establish what are the driver mutations that are present in that particular individual's cancer. And if the driver mutation is present, there are specific targeted therapy that is prescribed for that individual with that particular driver mutation, and they are treated accordingly based on that. But we have also to remember, though, although targeted therapy has taken us quite a bit over the last 10 years in terms of improving overall survival, there are a significant number of patients who do not have driver mutation, no driver mutation identified in them. In such patients, the choice of treatment still remains the standard chemotherapy that has been the standard for the last 30 years. And generally, the outcome for such patients are not as good as those in whom a driver mutation has been identified. I mean, there are enough clinical studies now to show that individuals with lung cancer, in the presence of a driver mutation and receive the targeted therapy specific to that driver mutation, generally do much better than those who do not. Overall survival has been shown to be much better in individuals who receive the appropriate treatment.
So when it comes to this picture of the driver mutations, though, Prof. Padma, this is an ongoing story, isn't it? Just because there's still a lot we don't know, researchers are working on identifying more?
Yes, and not only that, we are discovering mutations that drive the tumor forward, but we are also, NGS has enabled to discover mutations that actually adversely affect your therapies. So you may, for example, have a driver mutation and you say, oh, great. And then you have a drug that targets a driver mutation. But now we are finding that there are other mutations within this patient's tumor which actually mitigate their effort to have a successful therapeutic response. They actually are adverse predictive markers. These patients who harbor these so-called adverse mutations do not do as well as those who have them without these additional mutations. So that is also an important part of the whole equation. Not only do you want to find driver mutations, but you also want to be able to identify mutations which may not give you that good a therapeutic response as you would expect. The second point is that as these new driver mutations get detected, more and more drugs are coming into the market. Newer companies are coming out, and we've seen first generation therapies, and then we've now moved to, at least as far as EGFR is concerned, and Martin is probably the better person to talk about this. So there are second generation and third generation EGFR TKIs and so on. But cancer cells are clever. They become resistant. And again, NGS is useful because we are now able to deploy this powerful technology to pick up resistance mutations all in one fell swoop. So that is the challenge and also the promise of how we handle this constantly evolving tumor that is finding ways to survive.
That's almost science fiction stuff, right? That you can, that's what we try to do all the time. We're trying to stay a few steps ahead of the cancer cells, which are a lot cleverer than we give them credit for. So, Dr. Martin, what exactly does targeted therapy look like then? And Prof. Padma talked about first line, second line. How different are these from chemotherapy?
They are very different in the sense that targeted therapy for driver mutations are more specific. So much so the drug will actually been described as designer drugs. You design a drug to target a particular mutation. Chemotherapy, on the other hand, is a bit like people describe as a bit like carpet bombing, non-specific. You basically inject poison into an individual and you hope that the chemotherapy would affect the cancer cells, which are dividing rapidly. The difference, and of course, because of the way it works, chemotherapy tends to have much, much more side effects. And most people are very fearful of chemotherapy and the well-described side effects that they produce. Targeted therapy, on the other hand, in patients who have got driver mutation, tend to be more targeted. That's why it's called targeted therapy, because it targets a specific mutation. And because it's designed to attack a particular driver mutation, the side effects of these drugs tend to be slightly different from chemotherapy, but there are some side effects nonetheless. But on the whole, the side effects are generally milder. compared to chemotherapy. And most patients, if they respond, can remain on this drug for years, thus indicating that the degree of side effect that they may experience is tolerable and doesn't affect their quality of life as much as chemotherapy does.
And earlier you used the word curative. Do you mean that the lung cancer can be cured and the patient will be cancer-free?
Curing lung cancer is difficult. For us, we only talk about cure in patients with lung cancer if they are operable. So stage one and stage two lung cancers are generally potentially curable because they can undergo surgery that potentially can remove all the known disease sites. However, even those who have underwent so-called curative surgery, the relapse rate for such individuals are actually quite high, as much as 40 to 50%, even in those patients who appear to have the disease which is operable. Now, in the past, those patients who were operated on, who have got complete resection of the tumor, still undergo chemotherapy because there had been one big study that looked at operable cancer, a group that didn't receive chemotherapy versus a group that received chemotherapy. Those who received chemotherapy do very, very slightly better than those who didn't receive chemotherapy. And this study was done before the era of targeted therapy. Now, the presence of targeted therapy and the molecular precision medicine has complicated things a little bit for them. Now, for those who have undergone curative surgery, the specimen is still sent for molecular profiling to see whether there are any molecular drivers for their cancers. And in those group of patients in whom there is molecular driver for their cancers, they would also receive that treatment, the targeted therapy, in the so-called adjuvant setting. And there are also now enough studies to demonstrate that those who receive adjuvant therapy do better than those who did not receive adjuvant therapy. So that's how it has changed over the years.
And when you say do better, are we talking about survival? I know with cancer, we talk about 5-year survival rates and things like that.
Yeah.
How or what does that picture look like when you say do better?
Yes, when they do better, basically, we do better at two levels. The first level is the rate of relapse. When they relapse, do they relapse or don't? When they do relapse, what is the time frame at which they relapse? So on both counts, those who receive targeted therapy, in whom who operated, if they do relapse, they relapse much later, and the overall survival is also better compared to those who did not receive now. Yeah. So in that sense, when we talk about cure with lung cancer, if things generally don't come back within the first 5 years, generally one would say the disease will not come back. But one has to be mindful when you talk about that, because some causes of the lung cancer, especially in those who had lung cancer because they were smoking, if they do continue to smoke, their outcome is also not as good because they can develop second cancer, third cancers, and so on.
Prof, I've read about something called liquid biopsies. How does that fit into this picture of what we're talking about today?
Well, liquid biopsy holds great promise for the future, and I believe that it's going to be, at least in some situations, a game changer. So the technique requires that you take the patient's blood and treat it, extract the DNA, and that DNA will contain the patient's DNA, which is normal, and also a little bit of DNA from the tumor cells. Now, we have technology that is in place at the moment that even though these fragments of tumor DNA, or what we call circulating tumor DNA, or sometimes referred to as cell-free DNA or cfDNA, we are now able, even though the amounts are minuscule, we are able to actually retrieve that and in the laboratory make that minuscule amount to a number of copies of DNA that is significant enough for us to be able to analyze this. And so this is what we mean by liquid biopsy. So where tissue biopsy requires that you pass a needle into the tumor and take it out and send it for analysis, here what we are doing is in situations where the patient is too sick to biopsy, it's hazardous to biopsy, or the tumor may be in a site that is difficult to biopsy technically, then what we could do is take the patient's blood, extract the circulating tumor DNA, and subject that to analysis. And NGS can be used for this. And the same kind of tribal mutations can be investigated for. And if present, liquid biopsy has a high degree of specificity. That means if you find it, it's real, it's true, you can start treating the patient. However, the sensitivity level is still not as close as that of tissue biopsy. So if it's about 85 to 90% in the best of hands, so there is a chance that you will get a false negative result. It means that it may be there in the tumor, but for some reason, it's not appearing in the blood. And if you don't find it in the blood and you are really intent of chasing this to the limits, then under those circumstances, a tissue biopsy would be mandated because we really don't want to miss a driver mutation that may be life-changing for the patient.
But this is something that we're looking at only in the future?
No. We've been doing this for the past couple of years, actually. And we are offering that as part of routine service, as a diagnostic service. But it has to be used judiciously. Tissue is always still the gold standard. And liquid biopsy is in these special circumstances where you are, for some technical or health reason, unable to get a tissue biopsy. If I can just also tell you that liquid biopsy holds great promise for the future because there's nothing better than to take a patient's blood and then see whether they actually have lung cancer developing very early on. So it may actually come to that point when we can use it as a screening test. It's not there yet, but it may be possible in future, and I'm confident that it will because I can see how the technology is evolving. So I've already talked about how it may be used for diagnosis. The other way it's being used is monitoring. After the patient, if we detect a driver mutation, we treat that patient, the disease goes away. We can periodically test the patient's blood to see if the tumor is coming back. Because if it is, even small quantities of tumor cells may shed their DNA, and this would facilitate early detection of recurrence. So that's, again, a monitoring tool. And as I've said, NGS is powerful enough to detect even resistance clones that may be emerging, so allowing us the opportunity to intervene early. So I think this is an evolving technology, and soon it will get into the good practice guidelines and therefore provide some kind of criteria for us to be able to fall back on and deploy this technology in future.
All really exciting. I mean, we're talking about really cutting edge stuff here, but of course, there is a cost to it. So when we come back from the break, how do we ensure that cost isn't an insurmountable barrier when it comes to accessing these advances in lung cancer diagnosis and treatment? I'm speaking to Professor Dr. Padmanathan Rajadure, consultant pathologist, and Dr. Mati Melo Abdullah, consultant clinical oncologist, about game changers in lung cancer care. Stay tuned to Health and Living, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, T. Xiaoyik. I'm speaking to Professor Dr. Padmanathan Rajadure, consultant pathologist, and Dr. Mati Melo Abdullah, consultant clinical oncologist today. We're discussing how technology like next generation sequencing can lead to precision medicine in treating lung cancer. Dr. Martin, you yourself used the word designer drugs earlier, and that's, I guess, the layperson's term for things like targeted therapies. But we know that anything labeled designer is also expensive. So what happens if patients can't afford? I assume that even when doing things like the NGS, that the next generation sequencing, that kind of diagnostic test already comes at a cost.
It does, unfortunately. That comes with all these cutting edge technology treatment does come at a fairly high cost. And that is why the setting in which most of these treatments are available are mainly in the private setting. It would be very, very good if this could be available in the public sector setting. And that's one of the reasons why I think with regards to the outcome, as a nation, for example, as a nation treating lung cancer, our outcome are probably not likely going to be different over the next couple of years, because all this cutting edge technology and the treatment itself is not available to the masses, so to speak. I mean, it is available in the public sector, but only in a limited area. You know, with regards to cancer centers in the country, a lot of parts of the country are still not covered by any cancer centers that are able to treat them in a comprehensive fashion. So unfortunately, that's the current situation that we are in. That being said, the pharmaceutical companies are indeed trying to bring down the cost. We know that NGS as well, I think Dr. Parma can allude to this with regards to the collaboration between the lab and the pharmaceutical companies, making NGS more affordable. But, you know, when we talk about being more affordable, what level are we talking at? You know, we're not talking at the level of, you know, a few hundred ringgit, but a few thousand ringgit. With regards to the targeted therapy, on the other hand, they are also very costly. And again, pharmaceutical companies are providing some sort of patient support program. But again, having said that, they do come at a high price, unfortunately.
So, Prof, it's a few thousand ringgit just for the NGS testing, is that right?
Yes, but this few thousand, and I want to say, it used to be many magnitudes of thousands. So when we talk about how we started deploying this technology and offering it as a service, the cost was somewhere near 8,000 to 10,000, depending on which center was doing that. So this is clearly unrealistic. And so we decided that because the technology is so powerful, and at the moment beyond the reach of most cancer patients, with lung cancer patients, there must be something that's done to make it affordable. And so this was an initiative that we started in our healthcare facility, basically partnering with pharma and with instrument vendors and trying to get buy-in from them so that everybody contributes. Everybody tries not to make so much of money, but we are able to offer the technology at a cost that would not break the bank for most patients. So from a cost of maybe 8,000, we brought it down to 2,000. And that was the sponsored price that we basically offered to patients who qualify. And these are patients with newly diagnosed lung cancer. And moving forward, we've gone through at least three iterations of this program, each of them more successful than the previous. We are at that point when we are again re-strategizing as to how we can make it and break that 2,000 ringgit price point to even drop it further. This would mean we recruit more pharma partners. And pharma partners would be interested because as more driver mutations are being discovered, this is another opportunity for them to basically provide the drug to patients who would qualify, who have that driver mutation. So this is an ongoing effort, and we hope to be able to bring the costs down. And I'm quite bold enough to say that nowhere in the world has this kind of initiative been replicated. Partly because there are many legislations that are in place in other countries which prohibit pharma participation because they feel there's vested interest. So in Malaysia, I think we are fortunate that the greater good has prevailed, that more patients will benefit through public-private pharma industry partnership, as I'd like to think of it as a smart partnership, and everybody wins. So this is how I feel that we have been able to offer the technology at about 20% of the cost which it would otherwise have caused.
Does insurance cover diagnosis?
At least one insurance company has come forward to say that they will support precision medicine testing, which means next generation sequencing, provided it is recommended for by the oncologist and who feels that it is the necessary way forward for the patient to have the best standard of care.
That remains an ongoing discussion, actually, because the pharmaceutical companies may have got some leverage with the insurance companies, discussion with the insurance companies to get them to sponsor the testing. Basically, because then we, as far as treatment is concerned, is much more precise and hopefully bring bigger benefit to the patients without unnecessarily given treatment that may not really benefit the patient. So I think the insurance companies are realizing that. And Dr. Bama talked about one company, but I know of a few others who are, if you lobby them hard enough, at the individual patient's level, might cover the cost of the NGS.
So, you know, what we've covered today really is that reassurance that the science is moving ahead and we can offer more hope to patients with lung cancer now. But for me, I really feel that it still comes back to getting people diagnosed, and we just always want people with cancer to come in as early as possible. So perhaps you could share a final message on what all of us need to look out for when it comes to early detection of lung cancer. Prof, perhaps?
I think as a pathologist, for me, early detection would mean having a good enough biomarker test, a liquid biopsy test that can actually help us discover lung at the time of its genesis. At the moment, it is still pie in the sky. There's a lot of activity that's going on, but I'm sure that we are going to close that gap sometime in future. And then Dr. Martin has already talked about imaging, self-awareness, periodic checkups, looking at susceptible populations and having them subjected to maybe low-dose CTs. But these technologies are still being tested in the real world. One other thing that I want to perhaps just mention in parting is that we've spent a lot of time talking about next-generation sequencing and looking at driver mutations. But we also have to understand that there's an explosion of knowledge about immunotherapy. You asked me that question earlier about patients who do not have driver mutations. Immunotherapy is a promising avenue for these patients who do not have driver mutations and who have a biomarker called PD-L1, for example, that's expressed on the surface of the cells. And we have good studies that show that if tumor cells express this particular protein at a high enough level, more than 50%, some of them are disease-free for up to 5 years. So that's good information to have moving forward, that if you don't have a driver mutation, all is not lost. That the science is evolving and there are therapies that are looming in the horizon.
Dr. Martin?
I think it remains very challenging to get an early diagnosis in lung cancer, as I've alluded to the fact that majority present at a much later stage and there are no specific signs and symptoms indicating presence of lung cancer. And I've alluded to the fact that most of the screening studies that looked at patients with to detect early lung cancer had failed, except for the CT scan, low-dose CT scan that Dr. Bama did alluded to in patients who are, in individuals who are smokers and at higher risk of developing lung cancer. I suppose at this point in time, that remains the subgroup that one needs to be concentrating on, because there are good clinical data available in those group of patients where you screen them, you pick the disease early, you treat them early, you can achieve a higher cure rate in them as opposed to when they present symptomatically. But I suppose all is not lost. We know that the advancement in treatment comes at all levels of stage or all stages of the disease. We know that with early stage disease, even in those patients who are not able to undergo surgery, there are other forms of treatment available, for example, like what is called stereotactic radiosurgery can be done for small lung cancers that are not amenable to surgery on because of the complication from the lung. And with regards to surgery itself, there is aortic surgery and keyhole surgery also makes surgery a bit more acceptable with lesser complications. Now, in those who are advanced, we talked about targeted therapy, but a significant number of patients do not have any driver mutation. In those patients, chemotherapy is a standard of care. However, there are now advances in which the chemotherapy is combined with immunotherapy. And when you combine immunotherapy with chemotherapy in patients who do not have a driver mutation, their overall survival is improved compared to those who only receive chemotherapy. And I think I just want to make a comment with regards to the immunotherapy in those who had high so-called PD-L1 expression that Dr. Padma alluded to earlier on. And there was a study that actually did indeed looked at that. And the five-year survival of those who receive immunotherapy is much higher compared to those who did not receive immunotherapy in whom the PD-L1 expression is high. Yeah, so basically the message is that patients with lung cancer, all is not lost. There are many things that we can do. But having said that, I think lung cancer remains a very challenging disease to treat. And at this point in time, if you are not able to institute curative surgery, it still remains a disease that is going to cut short an individual's life.
So stop smoking, I think, would be something.
Yes. I think that would be very good if they can stop smoking.
In the meantime, science marches forward, right? And what I thought was science fiction, Prof. Padma has already convinced me that it is already here. But thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with me today. I've been speaking to Prof. Dr. Padmanathan Rajadure, consultant pathologist, and Dr. Martin Melo Abdullah, consultant clinical oncologist, about diagnosis and treatment of lung cancer. You've been listening to Health and Living, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.